You are tuned in to Copyright Chat. Copyright Chat is a podcast dedicated to discussing important copyright matters. Host Sarah Benson, the copyright librarian from the University of Illinois, converses with experts from across the globe to engage the public with rights issues relevant to their daily lives.
Welcome to another episode of Copyright Chat. It's been a minute. I've been on sabbatical. I've been traveling to Geneva, working at the World Intellectual Property Organization on some research. So welcome back. We have a very exciting episode talking about the Internet Archive litigation with Jonathan Band from Policy Bandwidth. He is a renowned lawyer in intellectual property and policy out of Washington, D.C. His views are his own. Nothing in this podcast should be taken as legal advice, of course. But welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So I would think, since this litigation has been pending for quite some time, that most of our listeners are familiar with it, but we can go through a little bit of background. So the Internet Archive was sued by authors and publishers because, largely, as I understand it, because of the emergency lending during COVID. Is that your understanding too? I mean, that's what prompted the suit?
Right. That was, the suit initially was filed right after the Internet Archive announced the National Emergency Library early in the pandemic. But very quickly, as you know, with the pleadings and sort of looking at where the decision ended up, the decision hardly focused on the National Emergency Library at all. That just got a paragraph in the decision. It was really focusing on the controlled digital lending under the Internet Archive's Open Library. So it was it could be that the National Emergency Library is what really got the publisher's attention. And that's what prompted the filing of the lawsuit. But the case ended up being about the Open Library more generally. And what's interesting about that is that was not new. I mean, the Internet Archive has been doing lending through the Open Library for a while. So, you know, I'm sure at some point in the future, we'll sort of look back and try to figure out, you know, why, what prompted it and why did they not sue about the Open Library earlier? But that's, you know, not completely relevant to today's discussion.
Yeah, I also think that's interesting because my own take on it, maybe not accurate, but my own take on it was that the authors got mad because they kind of went a little excessive, I guess, in the emergency library, saying, well, we're going to lend more than maybe 1-to-1. Well, and they claimed usually to be lending older books, maybe 5 years past publication date, but they threw a few newer books in there by mistake. I understand it was kind of not intentional on behalf of Internet Archive, and that was what kind of perked the ears up of the authors and the publishers. But yes, I mean, the case is broader than just the emergency library, which I think is important because some libraries, such as my own, were engaging in controlled digital lending through the HathiTrust during COVID because we couldn't let people in the doors. We had a pretty justifiable, I think, reason. And the fact that they brought in this lawsuit up probably made it harder on the side of the Internet Archive to justify what they were doing. I don't know. Maybe that's my own conclusion there. But the outcome, as we know, which recently happened, was an injunction that told the Internet Archive, as far as I understand it, to stop doing CDL essentially for now.
Right. Well, let's fine tune that a bit. So first of all, what happened is, you know, the lawsuit was initially filed back in 2020 when the National Emergency Library was opened. And then again, as I said, it sort of morphed into this focus on controlled digital lending by the Open Library more generally. The judge issued a decision in March of this year, so March 2023, basically saying that the Open Library's controlled digital lending with respect to 127 books issued in the case. So that was the 127 books identified by the publishers, Hachette and the other publishers involved in the litigation, you know, that it was not fair use for Internet Archive to distribute those titles through its open lending, its open library project in a controlled digital lending manner. Then the court said, okay, now parties, you figure out what happens next in this litigation, how we should proceed, what remedies should look like. And conceivably, there could have been additional a trial over damages. There could have been a trial over saying, what about other books beyond these 127? But instead, what happened is the parties started talking to each other and they negotiated, and they basically were negotiating. The judge, you know, the judge had initially wanted them to come back with a proposal within a couple of weeks, and they kept on asking for an extension, and the judge gave them extension after extension after extension. And finally, at the end of July, the judge said, no more. You guys decide, you have to do something within 2 weeks or else, I'm going to do it. And so then within 2 weeks, the parties came up with a proposed consent injunction. So they basically came up with a draft injunction, a proposed injunction that the court then approved. Now the injunction basically said that Internet Archive and its partners, which include some libraries that were working with the Internet Archive, would no longer reproduce or distribute covered books, and we'll get back to that in a minute, covered books through the Open Library. And then the question became, what is the meaning of the term covered books? And that's where the parties had a disagreement. And presumably that's what's been why there was all this delay. You know, it could be that they agreed pretty much early on most of the contours of the injunction, but that they couldn't agree on covered books. And covered books, the Internet Archive said covered books should just be books by these publishers, issued by these publishers, that are available in ebook form, sort of commercially through OverDrive or through Amazon Kindle. But they have to be, again, available in ebook form. The publishers, on the other hand, were saying, no, covered books should be any book that we publish or have published. You know, I don't think they were saying it necessarily needs to be in print. I don't 100% remember, but basically the issue is it ebooks, which are sort of currently available, or books generally? And so they submitted that question to the judge, and the judge very quickly, within a day, or actually over a weekend, the judge said, okay, covered books means ebooks, because what the Internet Archive argued is this whole case has been about ebooks and the fact that, the publisher said it's not fair use because we are selling these ebooks. We're making these available now in ebook form, and the Open Library competes directly with the ebook market. So the case is about ebooks. And so, and the judge agreed that this case was all about ebooks and the harm to the ebook market. And, you know, because that's what the case was about, the injunction can't be any broader than that. Can't talk about books generally. And so the injunction covers ebooks. But interestingly, it's not just this 127 titles. It's sort of any book that any book that these publishers publish in ebook format. And they're supposed to provide Internet Archive a list of their titles, and they will, and then the Internet Archive is supposed to pull those out of the open library. There is, the way it reads, it doesn't seem that it has to be titles that are now available in ebook. It could be if the publishers make other titles available in ebook, sort of like their backlist that's currently not ebook, that they can make them available as ebooks. And at that point, Internet Archive needs to pull those out. And it's also, even though this injunction just covers these publishers, there is sort of like the side letter where the Internet Archive, you know, at least that I don't know if that side letter has been made available, but the way it's been described is that in press releases is that other members of the Association of American Publishers, who sort of like were behind this litigation, if they want to sort of opt into this deal, they can do that too. And the, you know, I'm not 100% sure, but what the, you know, to what extent the Internet Archive is committed, but it's sort of like, if they don't do it, then they'll get sued. And, you know, they would have to do it, at least again, with respect to the ebooks. So that's the basic framework of the injunction.
Yeah. So for those folks listening who are not lawyers, injunction really means stop.
Yeah.
Steve, you are being ordered to stop doing this. If you don't, if you violate that, I'm assuming you're going to get damages imposed against you.
Well, yeah. You would be right. You'd be held in contempt. And in this case, yeah, damages, or, you know, it'd be fines would be imposed, you know. I suppose if it's sometimes with criminal contempt, you could go to jail, but I don't think that would happen here. But I'm sure they'll just, you know, there's no reason to believe that Internet Archive won't just comply and, you know, pull those titles.
Yeah. And also, as you pointed out, the one important factor is it's a consent injunction. So, you know, the parties did agree to this injunction, then the judge signed off on it. So, yes, I don't think there's any. There would be no reason they would be doing it intentionally. There might be an accidental thing that happens. But so you answered a lot of the questions. Like, I think this gives the publishers an incentive to start making more ebooks, would you think?
Yes. In theory, it you know, some of their backlist that is currently not available in ebook format, they might make available. But there's also the question as to why they haven't done that till this point. It could be that they just don't see any market at all for those titles. It could also be, and this is kind of like the dirty secret here, is that they don't know if they have the rights to make those titles available. You know, older titles, you know, the publisher agreement, you know, the agreement between the publisher and the author may have simply been that the author, the publisher, has the rights to publish it in physical form, because that's the technology that was known at the time. You know, in the 1970s or 1960s, you know, these are big publishers and they have, you know, lots of books. But it could very, very, very well be for those older titles, either the author actually has the electronic rights, not the publisher. Or it could be that it's unclear. No one knows, because the agreement is silent on that, or is ambiguous on that. And more importantly, it could be no one has a copy of the publisher's agreement. I mean, these are the kinds of issues that came up in the context of the Google Books case, you know, about 10, 15 years ago, And, you know, it was discovered, you know, there was a huge area of ambiguity. I mean, there were many cases where it simply was unclear who has the right to digitize those books. And again, with older books, to some extent, no one really cares. There's no market for it. And so that's why, you know, certainly, you know, let's say post 1990 or post 2000, it's all clear. Publishers made sure they had the agreement, or made sure the publisher's agreement said who had the rights. But it could be that the publishers have already made available in ebooks all the books that they really care about and that they really intend, or all the books that they have the rights to, and that the other stuff they really don't have the rights to. Or, you know, again, from a lot of those titles that are in the backlist, they really might not have the rights, and unclear who does.
Oh, that's a really good point. And as we both know, tracking down who owns the rights is never fun, especially if someone who wrote the book, who's the author, is deceased. Then you're really just looking down the family tree. And then are they going to get into some sort of bidding war with, you know, some kid who wants a big payout because their dad wrote some big book and really no one wants to read it with, you know? I mean, there is a reason some of these books are not available in ebooks, and a lot of the books that are currently lent through controlled digital lending, at least in my experience, are orphan works. Again, we just really don't even know who owns it. Maybe the publisher even went out of business. I mean, this is not for these books because they obviously know that they publish them, but they, you know, controlled digital lending, the aim is not to, you know, take a new release and start making copies of it, right? The aim generally is to get some books that are not available online to readers on a one-to-one basis. So, I mean, I guess what is the takeaway here? I mean, this case A isn't over, right? I think it's going to be appealed, right?
Right. So in the it's set forth in the order that the Internet Archive does not waive its right to appeal. And so one can safely assume that within the very near future, they will appeal to the case to the Second Circuit. And so, you know, a lot of the briefing likely will happen this fall. But the Second Circuit is not known for making decisions quickly. And so it could easily, you know, once the case is submitted, once, you know, the briefing's done and they have the oral argument, you know, again, it could take a while to schedule that. That could be, you know, into next year. And then, you know, there could easily be, you know, it could easily be a year, 2 years. It could take a while for them to get around to issuing a decision, particularly when there's a consent injunction, right? Because it's, you know, the parties have agreed to this injunction. To some extent, you know, it sort of signals to the court, well, the parties can live with this injunction, can live with this kind of status quo. And, you know, there's no urgency to make a decision. So we could, you know, it wouldn't just, you know, it could be 2025, late 2025 or into 2026 before we have a decision out of the Second Circuit in this case. On the other hand, I mean, it could be that they see this as an easy case and decided very quickly. I mean, unlike the Supreme Court, which, you know, decides all of its cases each term, you know, they move along. The courts of appeal don't have that same urgency. And so, again, it could happen very quickly or they could take their time about it.
They also don't have any say in whether they take the case. They have to take the case. I mean, I think it's an interesting question if the Second Circuit does take the case. I mean, once they make their decision, sorry, they don't have a choice. Once they make their decision, if it's the decision is against the Internet Archive and they decide to, and it gets appealed, or against the other, either party could appeal to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Would the Supreme Court care about this case? I mean, they just decided a big copyright case. So maybe it was a Second Circuit case.
That would be a very interesting question. I mean, you're exactly right. After the Second Circuit's decision, the losing side could petition for cert to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court. Yeah, I mean, it's up to the, you know, they have the choice whether they accept the case or not. I think it would be kind of an interesting case at that point for them. Maybe it would probably be more interesting if the Internet Archive wins in the Second Circuit, right? Then that would be, I would think that that would be more attractive. But if they lose at the Second Circuit, then that's a less interesting case, because it's sort of say, well, you know, okay, well, whatever they did went too far. So we don't need to look at what are the limits. But if I think the likelihood of the Supreme Court granting cert is greater if the Internet Archive prevails on appeal. One other thing is, it's pretty clear the publishers are not happy with the fact that the judge limited the injunction just, or interpreted covered books to apply just to ebooks. And it could, they could very well cross appeal, meaning they could appeal that. Even though that's kind of hard, because the standard for that would be an abuse of discretion. You know, so I think that's unlikely, because why, it would sort of unnecessarily antagonize the judge. And I think the reasoning of the judge is pretty solid, that, you know, all the evidence was about the ebook market. And so, you know, if he had covered books applied to all books, that would have been, better, that would have been a more likely an abuse of discretion that the Court of Appeals would have reversed on a, the Second Circuit would have reversed. So even it's a lot of things, it can go a lot of different ways going forward.
Right. And so to be clear, this case did not tell the Internet Archive, you have to stop using controlled digital lending as a method to reach readers. It told them, you have to stop lending these particular titles in ebook, or titles that might become available in if they make them available in ebook by these publishers.
Right. And again, yes. And so that does leave, it certainly leaves all other publishers sort of out of the litigation, even though there is a side letter that might bring publishers that are members of PN. And again, it does leave all the non-ebooks out. So that's right. I mean, it is somewhat limited in that sense. And it is different, and it doesn't apply to a lot of the kinds of controlled digital lending that various libraries are doing, certainly the kind of stuff that HathiTrust is doing, which again is much more circumscribed. And it also left out, things, relating to sort of anything that is similar to recent case law. So for example, the HathiTrust, the Authors Guild versus HathiTrust, and the Authors Guild versus Google Books, and Warhol. I mean, it is actually the consent injunction order specifically cited those as the kind of thing that is not, like when this injunction about what said, you can't make these reproductions, but you could conceivably make reproductions that are consistent with those decisions. And so that does give certainly, folks a lot of leeway, even if they're not even in part of this case. They can sort of say, well, what am I safe doing until, for the next couple of years until we have a resolution of this case? And it gives a lot of guidance.
Yeah, exactly. So I think some folks, I'm sure people who are engaged in CDL in their libraries, are thinking, what's my takeaway, right? I'm not in the jurisdiction of this court, right? I mean, I'm not a party to this lawsuit. Okay. But it's still helpful. It still provides some guidance, right? So if you are trying to engage in CDL and you're trying to lend a book that is available in ebook format, that might be less, that might be more risky, let's say, than if you had a book that was older, not available in ebook, you know, maybe even an orphan work, that kind of a thing. And so I think it's still good guidance and even better guidance probably if the Second Circuit affirmed, right? Because then it's like, okay, well, the circuit courts tend to follow each other, look at each other. And like I'm in the Seventh Circuit, for instance, you know, I know the Second Circuit doesn't bind what we do at University of Illinois, but if the Second Circuit is leaning a certain way, I'm going to think, that's probably pretty good guidance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, but one can't overstate the case. So you can certainly say that, let's say the Second Circuit affirms the district court, and, you know, also with the, you know, that makes it clear that this is just about ebooks, then that could say, then an institution could say, okay, well, you know, we're pretty, you know, we feel somewhat degree of confidence that if we, or we know that if we engage in CDL for books that are currently available as ebooks, that would likely, that's probably, you know, a red zone, right? That raises flags. That might be dangerous. You don't necessarily know that if it's not an ebook that you're in the clear. All you know is that if it's not an ebook, this case doesn't say anything about it. So it could be, you know, the language of the Second Circuit, the way it says what it's not deciding, could be important, you know, but I think it would, you know, then it would basically leave, you know, existing sort of, you know, fair use jurisprudence and people's judgment, and certainly say, well, okay, if it's an older title, an orphan work, that's pretty okay, you know, but what about if it's not that old a title? Let's say it's, you know, a book in the 80s, right? And, you know, the author is still alive. Is that okay? Unclear. But I'm not sure. I think right now, even before the decision, I think a lot of university counsel will say, nah, that's not, you know, that's, you know, already a little too risky, and would say, well, no, it's got to be, you know, before a certain date or, you know, something else, you know, something the 80s be a little too recent, especially if, you know, if it's from a real university press or a real publishing house, that might not be making the whole title again. But you know, it could be that, you know, the real question coming forward is, you know, you can imagine all kinds of litigation as people try to refine what's okay and what isn't okay. I suspect there probably won't be a lot, because it's just not worth it to the publishers. I mean, I think that they felt that the Internet Archive, especially once, you know, when it had the National Emergency Library, that was just kind of like just too far. It just couldn't tolerate that. And then once they started litigating, they realized, well, wait a minute, we can't say that, you know, CDL is okay, but the National Emergency Library isn't. I mean, they couldn't, I don't think they could see, they felt they could make that kind of concession. So they sort of backed into a corner, that, you know, because the Internet Archive had gone so far, they felt they needed to say, okay, no, you know, no to CDL, at least in these circumstances. But I think, again, part of it is, you know, it's clear in all the pleadings, you know, they really don't like the Internet Archive generally. I mean, they feel that and it could be the Internet Archive maybe sort of poked the bear too many times from their point of view. And they sort of, you know, there was a lot of in the pleadings, they talked a lot about, oh, the Internet Archive isn't a real library, blah, blah, blah. you know, so it could very well be that if you change the facts and if it's University of Illinois Library and it's, you know, maybe it is books from the 70s and 80s, but, you know, the university can put together a rationale that not only is it trying to make these titles more available, it has all sorts of statistics that no one has checked this book out in 15 years or 20 years, which is often the case. And it could also talk about the whole CDL thing is also part of the rationale is, you know, managing its collection, managing its space. It doesn't have enough room to hold all these, or the cost of, you know, it could come up with various rationales that then that might tip the balance. And that would be, the reasoning would be different. It could make arguments that couldn't, the Internet Archive couldn't make. But I have a feeling no one's going to litigate that stuff. I just don't think libraries will be careful, and, you know, sort of like, let's say when they are in books, you know, titles that are in the 80s or whatever, they'll be very selective about what they do and do. And it would be, let's say, a title that has not been circulated in 20 years or 40 years, right? And I'm sure you have titles like, on the other hand, you know, the publishers will be sort of reticent. I mean, litigation is really expensive. It seems that there was an agreement here where the Internet Archive is going to pay their legal fees, the publisher's legal fees, but nothing else, no damages. It's sort of like reading between the lines. That seems to be what the situation is. But litigation is really expensive. And I think they realize that unless it's something kind of really egregious from their point of view, they're not going to bother. So I think there'll still be a lot of ambiguity. There'll be a big gray zone. And because even the publishers and the Authors Guild and other groups, you know, certainly in private conversations, they say, oh, we have no problem with orphan works. You know, it's just, you know, but of course their definition of an orphan work might be different from our definition of an orphan work, right? So there's going to be, you know, certain areas where it's going to be very safe, certain areas where it's going to be pretty risky. And then there's going to be this big gray area in the middle. And I think that that's going to, you know, continue to pose a challenge for libraries. Again, all this is assuming that the Second Circuit affirms. If they reverse, it's obviously very different.
Right. And in terms of the super risky, you know, to me, that is always the textbook situation. People say, oh, I want to put this textbook through CDL. What? No. Please don't do that, because textbooks are such a small market, right? I mean, you have a Calculus 101 textbook. That's really just for those I'm not going to read that textbook. That's not that's not for just anybody. That's for a very small market. On the other hand, don't even get me started about the price of textbooks, because.
I agree with you. I mean, textbooks, that would be. Yeah, I mean, you know, making textbooks available would be problematic, unless, again, you know, it's let's say it's an older textbook that no one is using in courses anymore. So let's say, you know, the second edition of, you know, Samuelson and Economics, and now there's probably up to the 30th edition, right? I mean, so an older edition where the only person who would be looking at it would be a scholar, right? I mean, I think in every case you could sort of make generalizations, but even then, it's going to be, you know, I think there could be circumstances under which sort of saying, yeah, making the third edition of the Samuelson Economics textbook is on a CDL basis is a fair use.
That's a good point. Yeah, I could see a historical analysis of a textbook that's really old would be a very different thing than current textbook.
Something like Samuelson, which is, you know, that has been the bedrock of economics courses, you know, again, since long before I took economics. So it's been around. That textbook has probably been around for 50 years or more, and sort of seeing how it's evolved. That seems like a good research, you know, topic for a doctoral dissertation if it hasn't already been done.
Yeah, so it's just another way to say that, you know, fair use is flexible and you really can't just put a line in the sand. Even I just tried to put a line in the sand, didn't work.
Right, that's right. That's why it's, you know, that is the beauty and the frustration of fair use.
The beauty, I think it's beautiful. I think it's a good thing, right? It gets frustrating for people in their day-to-day work. They want these hardline rules. But on the other hand, it allows us to do things and be flexible in ways that counterparts across the world who don't have fair use cannot do it. And so, you know, we also then have to keep up on all the fair use decisions so we can understand what the courts are saying about it, which is a whole nother thing. Well, I hope in terms of keeping up on the decisions, I hope that this discussion, I know it's been really enlightening for me. Jonathan, you have such a bird eye view of what's been going on, much more nuanced than my understanding. So thank you so much. And I hope it's been helpful to listeners. I'm sure it has. I mean, it's just been so interesting to listen to your thoughts about this case. And it's not over yet, but at least this is something that will be probably in place for a while, right? While the appeal is pending. So it's good to understand where we are now and where we're headed. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Jonathan. It was really nice talking to you.
Well, it was my pleasure.